accession number 28642, Reel 7.
This is the fourth reel of a tape interview with Max Sheen in his home in Perth, Western Australia. On the 30th of the 9th, 2005, at the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. Max, obviously you were telling us about cutting through.
Yes. I think I got to the stage where I was given command of X5 and told to concentrate on net cutting until we'd solved all the difficulties. So I spoke to all the people who had an unsuccessful attempt at cutting through a net and got their story, and then analysed their story from the engineer's point of view on what they could have done better. I already mentioned that deciding on exactly which wires to cut was the first step, so that you cut the minimum number for maximum effect, and you only had to cut four. The other thing is that you had to judge the submarine's trim, because while she's locked in the net, or got her nose stuck in one of the spaces of the net, the first attendant doesn't know whether she's heavy or light, because her depth is maintained by the net, not by his trim. So the diver had to examine the way the submarine was nestled in the net. And you could tell if she's heavy, then a bow will be weighing down on the lower strands of the net. If she's light, it'll be bearing up on the upper strands of the net. So he's got to make an assessment of her trim, and if he judges, for example, that she's heavy, he'd to go back to where a short periscope was located in the middle of the submarine, and the captain can watch the diver at work with his periscope, and to make a signal to pump water out, or pump water in, as the case may be. Then he goes forward again, and you can tell when the pump is going on, you can hear it. You hear it in your ears, you hear the pump running. And what's more, if you look at the side of the submarine, you can see the water flowing from the tank, because the water's always a little bit opaque because of the rust in the tank. So he goes forward and has to look, and when he's satisfied the submarine is in good trim, then he cuts the wires in a special order. So this was my idea of how to make a successful cut, and I wrote all this down. And the first lieutenant of the submarine was a man called Henty Creer. He was of a family who'd been in Australia for five generations, and he's very proud of this. He's telling everybody about it. But he had joined, in fact, from Canada, where he was working for a film company making a film called 49th Parallel, which is a pretty popular film made by the Department of Information. And he joined the Navy, he joined the Royal Navy, although he was Australian. He was a very proud fellow, very intelligent, man of great personality, but fairly limited technical understanding. But his ambition was to have command of X-5 for this operation against Tibbets, although he was junior of all the officers who were otherwise qualified to take command. Anyway, he was my first lieutenant, and so I went through with him my method, or proposed method of penetration, and he said, right, well, I will do the first cut. Now, that was typical of Henty. Centre stage front with Henty. He'd come from the film industry, and he was still, he had to be the prima donna. Well, okay, I said, that's fine, you do the first cut. Well, Henty had had several goes before, and he'd lost consciousness each time. Fortunately, he recovered, or was recovered. He'd only had an attendant to rescue the unconscious diver. So out we went the next day in X5, and whenever we were doing a practice on a net, there's always a Navy boat moored to the net above where we were working. They could tell where the submarine was, because when a submarine going at about 2 knots intercepts the net, it always displaces the net. The people up top could see the buoys all move along, and they know the submarine's under there. So there's a naval whaler aboard above us as we're trying. As we're nestled in the net at 30 feet depth, I just helped Henty dress, and he got into the wet and dry compartment, it was called, otherwise W&D, because he fills with water and empties with water. So he got into the W&D, and He shut the door of the control room, and then he started to work the valves. Now, the valves can be worked from both sides, from within the compartment and from in the control room. And as soon as the diver starts to open the valve, if he's doing the right thing, the commanding officer on the other side gives him a hand, does the rest of the work for him. And that's as long as he's adhering to the drill. Well, Henny got to the stage of pumping the compartment full of water, and then he started to do some strange things with the valves. Well, that's just not on. So I took over and put the valves in position to pump down the compartment, and I ran the pump down. And when it got empty, I opened the door, and there was Henty, obviously having a fit. So we pulled him into the control room, pulled his mouthpiece out, and opened his visor, got him breathing on air, and then set him down while he went through the antics of a man who'd lost self-control. So while he was alive and quite okay, I backed a submarine out of the net and came to the surface. And the whaler came alongside, and we got Henty up on deck, got him out of his suit, and he said he was perfectly all right, nothing wrong with me, I'm okay. And I said, well, you weren't okay a couple of minutes ago, you'd lost the plot, you weren't conscious. So he said, what do we do now? I said, do you think you're capable of conning the submarine? Oh yes, he said, nothing wrong with me, I'm right. This is Henty, he's full of self-confidence. He had so much self-confidence that it killed him in the end. So I said, all right, we'll have another go. You con the submarine and I'll do the cutting. So then we went, and the whaler went back to the net, and I put the submarine into the net, and I said, all right, I'll get into the suit now. So I dressed up, got into the compartment, went through the procedure, and it went like clockwork. While I was working on the on the net, a diver came down from the whaler. He was the attendant diver to rescue me when I lost my consciousness, which I didn't do. So I cut the four wires, and I had to pump out what heavy would she was before I started cutting. So we pumped out once, and then she was lying quite nicely. Cut the four wires, and she went through nice and easily. It was beautiful, nice and slow, all down in green water, very clear. It was a magnificent sight. You see this submarine shifting along, going through the hull. And I walked back along the submarine to make sure the nets didn't catch on anything. And as I got to the stern, I could see the diver hanging like this.
thumbs up,
yes. So I got back into the WND and back into the control room. And Henty said that took 12 minutes. So that was all right, it was done. So we solved the problem. So we got something on the surface and made our peace with the whaler, and we went ashore. And I phoned up to the headquarters, which is at the bottom of the lock, and told the captain in plain language, because you couldn't talk secrecy on the telephone unless you can scramble, which we couldn't do, just decoding or coding the conversation. I said, we've had one successful try, we'll do a few more. So we did that, and the next thing, we got a message saying, there's an empty torpedo net there, we're not too sure about how we negotiate that. We know they go to the seabed where Tirpitz is. See if you can lift the bottom of the net with an airbag and get underneath it. So Henty and I went out the next day with an airbag and a cylinder of oxygen, or whatever in air, and went down. It was 60 feet deep. Now, at 30 feet, you've got almost unlimited endurance. At 60 feet, you've got about 10 minutes. So we attached the bag and opened the valve from the air bottle and made that fast to the net. And we were waiting for the air to go in, and I saw Henty. He left the net and he was going around like this, his hands in front of him, and he's slowly rotating. He was on a lifeline, at the end of his lifeline. And when he faced me, I made a rude sign to him, and he didn't respond. So I thought, he's out, he's lost it again. So the system of signals, one pull on the lifeline, then answer me. So I gave one and got one back. Then I gave four, which means panic, get him up. So I gave this on Henty's lifeline, so they pulled Henty up. So up he went, and I grabbed his boot as he went, and I went up with him. And when we got to the top, it was shambles, two divers and lines everywhere. So I said, get him inboard. You can't say anything, he had little signals. So they got Hendy inboard and they got me inboard, got him out of his suit, and he was climbing up. He wanted to walk ashore from the whaler. We had to hold him back in the boat. And then later on he said, "I'm perfectly all right, nothing wrong with me." This is his great ambition and self-confidence. Anyway, I didn't know at the time, but I know now that Hendy got on the blower to the captain of the flotilla, and he said, well, the first trial, Sheen was conning the submarine and we failed. The second time, I conned the submarine and succeeded. So he pretty stocks up to the, I didn't know this. That's a working mug. We spent a few weeks repeating this trial, and in the end we came back to the depot. I got a message from the captain to hand over command to Hetty Creer.
So you were mentioning earlier that you would hand over command, or have to hand over command, to Hetty. Let's talk about that.
Yes, well, when that happened, I was put in command of X3, which is one of the first two prototype boats which preceded the six operational boats built by Vickers Armstrongs. And that was only somebody to park me while all the rest got on with preparing for the attack on Tirpitz. And I stayed looking after X3 until the sailing for Tirpitz was imminent. At that stage, the diver in X9 lost his confidence and pulled out. And so I was appointed in his place. So I went from a commanding officer down to a diver, but that was all right. It suited me. But in the meantime, a lot of other trials have been carried out, and one which I think is certainly worth mentioning is towing. Because the target was 1,000 miles from Britain, and our total range was only 1,000 miles, we were to be towed. The X-craft were to be towed from north of Scotland to the sea off Alton Fjord, and then released to do their attack, come out, pick up the tow again, and tow home. Now, towing might sound pretty straightforward, but in fact it's not. It's a very hazardous operation, and I went on the very first trial tow from the Clyde up to Jackalus Bay. It's just south of Cape Roth. I was towed by a submarine, Tuna. She was a T-class boat, displacing about 1,000 tonnes, which was one of the bigger submarines in those days. And in the very first minutes of the tow, which is down the Clyde, which fortunately is quite deep, we had bother keeping the X-craft under control. They have a tendency to porpoise, that is to go deep until they get to the stage where the tow pulls it up again, then they come up and break surface and go deep again. And during these evolutions, they take on a very steep angle, and people are left up to slide along the deck. And if there's any loose gear, that slides along the deck too. But I took over from the electrical artificer who was on the hydroplanes and managed to get the submarine under control again. And it altered the trim, and we found out by pumping water in, making the submarine heavy, and pumping the water forward, making the bow heavy, that eventually they would tow along at a safe depth, about 40 or 50 feet, level, and fairly stable. But all the time, we had to beware against any porpoising. In calm water, that's not so bad, but when there's a swell, obviously the towing submarine is pitching, and that gives the tow rope a pull up every time she goes over a wave, and that's have to start the X-craft from porpoising. But you've got to be vigilant all the time when on tow. It's far more relaxed when you're going independently. Mm. And in fact, we lost two submarines on tow with the entire crew. So I think that was the biggest cause of the loss. The other hazards we had to reckon with in entering an enemy harbour were the anti-submarine nets, which I think I've spoken about, and the need to cut through them if necessary, the anti-torpedo nets, which we had tried to penetrate but couldn't because the British anti-torpedo nets made of grommets of hardened steel, and our cutters wouldn't deal with that. Used to break the blades of the cutter. And anyway, we'd have to cut a large number of these grommets to get through. We had tried lifting the anti-torpedo nets, which went to the seabed, with an airbag, but we found that that was impractical too. We couldn't lift them far enough to get an X-craft through. So it would seem that we'd have to find the gate, because, of course, the Germans would have to have a way of getting through the net themselves with their boats, the Liberty boats and Storrs boats and so on. And when Tirpitz itself would put to sea, no doubt the anti-torpedo nets would have been drawn aside by a tug to go through. Now, we couldn't hope to correspond or to synchronise with that, but we reckon we could get through the gate that the Germans were using. And in fact, X6 did that. She got through the gate. The other hazards were the anti-detector loops, as they're called. That is a double loop of cable laid on the seabed at the entrance to a harbour, and the cables pick up submarine's magnetism or ship's magnetism. It's known as a signature.
You mentioned how you sort of degauze the submarines.
Yes.
You also mentioned in your book minefields.
Yes. Well, the minefields, the way to get through those is to know where the swept channel is, because once again the enemy has to get his own ships through the minefields. There was a minefield in the case of Tirpitz laid in the ocean in the approaches to Oldenfjord. Now, I don't recall that we knew the passage through that, but we reckoned that if we went through on the surface at high tide, we wouldn't detonate the mines because they were laid, of course, for big ships, and we only drew about 8 feet, so we probably fled over the top of them. And I don't think anybody had any bother with mines getting into Oldenfjord or getting out again. But when we went to Bergen, there were two declared minefields within the approaches to Bergen. That is inside the outer seaward islands. But there we were told where the swept channels were, because the intelligence from Bergen was very good, brought by Norwegian fishermen who could leave Norway and come over to Shetland, pass on the information and go back again. And this went on quite a lot. They're very brave men and very intelligent men, and they gave us a lot of information, including where the swept channels were through the minefields. We went through two minefields on the way to Bergen, and of course the same two minefields on the way home again, without detonating anything. So that worked very well. Of course, you've also got to reckon with the patrols. The patrol ships keeping a sonar watch and a radar watch and a visual watch. So we have to make not too much noise and give them a wide berth so we couldn't be seen and probably not picked up on radar.
Was it essential that you get the submarine into the harbour? Were there alternatives to that?
No alternatives at all. We had to get to the target. And the target was in near the city of Bergen, in a dockyard. And there are a lot of other channels, but these were the ones we were recommended to take through the main channel, because we had the position of these swept channels.
You mentioned in your book too the other cock-ups. You mentioned a couple, but the main mistakes made.
Yes, well, there were many cock-ups made. In fact, my first lieutenant, when I had an operational submarine, was Joe Brooks. He was a sub-lieutenant, Royal Navy, a very nice fellow, very competent, and he was also a good artist. And whenever anybody made a mistake during the training, Joe would be inclined to draw a cartoon and put it up on the wardroom notice board. So that was a very good scheme for getting people to take more care, because nobody likes to be made a fool of in the view of all the other trainees in the flotilla. And this method was used to great effect by the Royal Air Force, who created a character called Pilot Officer Prune. And Pilot Officer Prune was the man who made all the mistakes that there were to be made. And they published him in a book called TM, which meant Training Manual. And Joe Brooks took the idea from this, and he created a sub-lieutenant Prune doing the same things. But I made a few myself. One favourite cock-up is to, when you open up the diving, you open up all the valves that you've got to have open and make sure you shut the valves that have to be shut. But one of the valves that's got to be open was the valve supplying the depth gauge. The depth gauge is really only a pressure gauge, calibrated in feet of water. And when you shut off from diving at the end of the day, you shut the valve, the whole valve that supplies the depth gauge, just in case the depth gauge should spring a leak while nobody's on board and sink the submarine. And it's a pretty common mistake when you open up for diving to forget to open up the depth gauge. So when the captain orders dive, 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 which is always what he says because you can't mistake it for anything else, down you go, and the fellow back aft who's keeping depth is waiting for the submarine to submerge, and his depth gauge is still reading zero. And that happened to me once when we really hit the bottom. Well, the depth gauge is still reading zero. Didn't do any harm, fortunately, but that was my mistake, and that was duly put on the wardroom notice board. There's another one, but the connection between the main engine and the main motor and the propeller were by two clutches. Now, they're not like motor car clutches, which can be engaged when the engine's running and the motor car is stopped because it has discs which would slip. These were dog clutches, which are really a geared clutch, which is either in or out. It doesn't slip. And sometimes people try to clutch in or clutch out with the engine running and the propeller stopped, and that caused a gnashing of teeth. And I didn't do this, but one or two others did, because the thing to do is to, if you're going to stop the engine, put the clutch in and then start the engine. And that happened between engine and motor and propeller. That was not very serious. I don't think we ever damaged the clutch that way. But the worst thing you can do with an engine is to start it going backwards. Now, in a motor car, you can't do this because when you push the starter button, the starter motor always runs in the right direction. But in these small submarines, you started the engine with the main motor. And the main motor is used for propelling the submarine ahead and for propelling it astern. And when you start the engine using the main motor, you've got to make sure that the main motor is set to run ahead, not astern. But a couple of times, an attempt was made to start the engine with the motor running astern, and Joe Brooks himself did this once. It was one time when I was aboard the submarine, and we were doing some trials to measure the turning circle. And the captain had been going ahead on the engine, and he had to suddenly stop, so he called out, "Stop, full astern." He should have said, "Stop, out engine clutch, full astern." So Joe did what he was told. He stopped and then ran the motor astern, which ran the engine astern. And when you do that, the engine sucks in seawater from the exhaust pipe and tries to compress it. And of course, you can't compress it. And in one revolution, so you wrecks the whole engine. You bends connecting rods, which then punch a hole in the sump, and it just ruins the engine. So that was another misdemeanor. Joe produced a book of these cartoons, and he called them mainline cocks, which is, has two meanings. A cock is like a valve, but a cock is also a mistake, a cock-up. And he gave me this book when he left the flotilla, and I've still got it. And I read through it every now and then and see my own name in print.
You're mentioning also Scottish farmers and your connection with them.
Yes, well, when we did our advanced training in Lough Cairnbourne, which is just south of Cape Roth. It's rather uninhabited country, but there are one or two farms around. And, of course, the farmers know what's going on. They see the depot ship, and they see the small submarines, and they know it's secret. And as far as I know, the enemy never learnt from the farmers or anybody in Britain what we were up to. All the same, they did speak among themselves about it. And when I met a young lady who is now my wife, she lived in Aberfeldy, which is in the middle of Scotland, whereas I was sometimes attached to HMS Bonaventure, our depot ship, in Loch Cairnvorne. And when I wasn't there, I was operating for the island of Bute, both in Scotland. And I never told my fiancée what I was doing, but she knew what I was doing, because somebody in Bute, in the Clyde, knew somebody in Aberfeldy, which is where Mary lived. And so one told the other, and my bride-to-be found out what I was up to, because she didn't tell me either. And I didn't really tell her until after the attack on Turbots. And then I said, well, that's where I'd been. I thought she had the right to know what sort of a character she was marrying. And the farmers were very good to us, they're very, very generous. They would do us a favour by supplying us with fresh milk, which, of course, we didn't have on the ship. And because you can't get something like milk, you want it. But when we went to pay them for it, they would never take any money. And there was one incident that I mentioned in my book, that off Loch Cairnvorne, there are two other lochs, one called Loch Glendhu and the other one is Loch Glencool. And these are both quite deep. And we used to use those for exercises. And one time we were on a stealth exercise, and we had to get into Loch Glendhu without being seen, manoeuvre all day submerged without being seen. We were allowed the surface for lunch, but we had to be out of sight of the one and only farm at the very head of the loch. There's a bit of alluvial ground which can be farmed. The rest of the loch side is all very steep and rocky. So we very carefully avoided being seen all day. And except at lunchtime, we moored to the rocks out of sight and walked along the bank of the loch with a bucket to see if we could buy some milk. We saw the farm there, went and knocked on the door, and the farmer's wife came out. And we were in uniform, so she knew who we were. So we said, could we buy some milk? So she went and put some milk in our bucket, but wouldn't take any money. Well, next day we were up there again, and we decided we'd take some chocolate from the canteen to give to the farmer, because he had we knew he had a little girl, because we'd seen her. So we did the same thing very carefully, surfaced out of sight of the farm, and moored the submarine, and went around. And this time the farmer was out in the field making hay, and his little girl was sitting on the hay rick. And when we came up to him, he said, oh, I'm surprised to see you today, because we Ishbel thought it was a different submarine. So we didn't keep anything from their gaze. Anyway, he accepted the chocolate. And I met Ishbel only a few years ago. And she was now a mother, about to become a grandmother. So I gave her a copy of my book, and I was so pleased to see that she survived the war. And I hope she'd married a good husband.
But an interesting look at how civilians in this isolated part of the world were interacting, were surviving through the war.
Yes, the people in that north country of Scotland, I think they did pretty well, because most of them were farmers, or they had access to farm produce. And a little to the west of where Bonaventure was moored, there was a village called Ned and one called Drumbeg. And the road to these hamlets, you'd call them, I suppose, was very narrow and very steep. And we had a motorbike attached to the ship, and we used to pop along there on the motorbike to see if we could get some eggs. And I used to send these eggs down to Mary. And they travelled quite well by post, the eggs. You wouldn't think they did. And But they did, and one time I called on the motorbike to collect the eggs from a lady called Marion Stewart, and she made a little speech. She said she knew I was a very faithful person because I was sending these eggs down to my fiance, but you can't trust all the sailors, and she's quite right about that. But I don't know whether there was ever any scandal, except one of the ship's officers married one of the people from Drumbeg, and as far as I know, it was a happy marriage.